Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 178 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. And now, on to our read-along! This week, we are discussing It Sounds Like a Lot, because we're doing chapters 20 through 23. However, it's only like 17 pages, so calm down, guys. So, we're going to start off this week's read-along with chapter 20, entitled Diagnosis.
Claire is meeting with Joe, that is Dr. Joe Abernathy, her BFF from med school and her internship, in his office. He's looking at a business card of Lenny's, his son's, who we find out has changed his name from Leonard, I'm guessing, Lenny, to Muhammad Ishmael Shabazz, the third. Don't forget the third. Deborah C. writes, we learn a bit more about Joe Abernathy's family and his son's efforts to reclaim his African heritage, which was stolen from slaves and their descendants, but also to feel more at home at Yale, where many students had junior or the third, etc., after their names. Joe talks about Lenny's search for his own heritage, wanting to get to his African roots, how he will feel out of place at Yale when he meets people with these old illustrious names when he doesn't even know where his grandfather came from. He jokes that all Claire has to worry about is whether or not Bree will do drugs or come home pregnant by a draft dodger. Claire responds, that's what you think.
For real, though.
Oh, my goodness. So what do you think about Lenny? And the names and hearkening back to, they're kind of setting us up for the whole Jamaica, right? I mean, we don't know yet. If you're a first-time reader, or when you're a first-time reader, you don't know. But can't give away spoilers, but yes, I get it. Joe is African-American, and thus his son is African-American. But, you know, starting off the chapter with a need to link oneself to one's heritage is not just about Lenny and Joe and Joe's father. It's kind of laying the groundwork for what's to come.
But it's also continuing.
Mm-hmm.
Continuing the existing search, if you will, for roots. I found it comical that the whole statement about, well, he changed his name and now I'm a junior.
Like exactly. By
him. He's like, you know.
That was great. That was great.
He's like, you know, 2 days ago, this is just who I was. But now apparently I am inadvertently XYZ the third or the second or whatever. And I thought it was funny.
It was very funny. Claire is tying up loose ends before planning her trip back to Jamie. The discussion of Lenny and his name change is symbolic, I think, of this want or need to be connected with who or what you are or where you come from. Claire, while born in the 20th century, belongs in the 18th century with Jamie. Her making her way back there is similar to Lenny changing his name to connect with something important to him. And then, of course, Brianna is looking for her history, Claire says. Then a young man from the Harvard Anthropology Department enters Joe's office, looking for him. He'd brought a box of something for him to look at, but Joe thinks Claire would be a help. He brings out a skull and presents it to her. All he tells her is it's female, it's fully grown, mature, and maybe late 40s or middle 50s. Claire gives it a look. She goes over each bone of the skull, naming it in her mind, and notices the high, broad cheekbones and straight white teeth, and its deep eyes. As she held it against her, eyes closed, she felt, quote, the shifting sadness filling the cavity of the skull like running water, and an odd faint sense of surprise, unquote. She says that someone had killed this woman, and this woman did not want to die. Mr. Thompson from the university says that this skeleton was found in a cave in the Caribbean, and it is maybe 150 to 200 years old. Claire thought She'd been helping out with a more modern unidentified body, and she's a lot taken aback and shocked and a little bit perturbed that Joe pranked her. Joe takes out the vertebrae, piecing them together, and shows a deep gouge he finds in one of them. Quote, "Someone tried to cut this lady's head clean off with a dull blade," unquote.
I think that in this section, it highlights very distinctly the differences between med students / doctors and theater people. Because I guarantee you, any theater person who's handed a skull is going to say something along the lines of, "Alas, poor Yorick, I knew you well." They will be replaying the Hamlet scene from the grave if you're handed a skull. I mean, that's what you do.
I thought of Hamlet immediately. Claire says that she didn't know how she knew the female had been killed. It just felt like it. Joe says that she, quote, does this all the time, and that she's the best diagnostician he'd ever seen.
But how awkward would that be with a real live person? Like,
not a skull, but a body?
Yeah.
A human, body?
If she's in, like, you know, a room with a patient, she's like massaging their head or randomly going, I think it's, you know, just having some sort of epiphany that makes no sense because she was standing next to the patient. I'm just saying it would be much less awkward with a skull.
Well, for them, no. For her, maybe, because it's not going to respond. But for the people watching her, it's more awkward because she's doing it to a dead body with, like, supposedly she shouldn't be able to tell from an inanimate object what's going on or what went on, God, let alone what went on. But I think basically, and this was written before the show, but I think Joe is meaning that she's like a house.
A brick house?
Like, no, Dr. House.
She's mighty, mighty. Just letting it all hang out.
Goodness. So Joe announces that it also wasn't a slave and that the femur to tibia ratios of the two races are different enough to be measured and thus apparently be scientific. I'm going to trust Diana on that. If we have any doctors or med students or people, just researchers, anyone who happens to know and can a citation or whatever, that's very interesting. Anne S. writes, "Speaking of coincidences, a murdered lady's skeleton is found in a Caribbean cave. Didn't think a thing of it the first time I read this, but now I wonder if there could be something more significant here. Also, I wonder what the African artifacts might be." Now, Anne, you did not go too much further, so we kept your comment in, but we can't say too much, but let me just say you're on the right track.
And let me just say that if you finish the book, you'll know exactly what kind of artifacts were around the skull.
It might have been. Well, and you might know if there's something more to the skull.
The show.
Then Claire gets down to business. She needs a male's objective opinion about whether or not she's attractive. And Joe doesn't disappoint. He says, "Skinny white broad with too much hair, but a great ass. Nice tits, too."
Exactly.
Anne S. writes, "Now we come to the point of Claire's visit to Joe's office today. Is she fit to show herself to Jamie again without him going, ew? Of course she is. Jamie may be the king of men, but Claire is an unusual woman. Did you see the funny set of tweets between Sam and Kate about Jamie getting fat when he got older and then posting a picture of the Mike Myers fat bastard?
A fat bastard. Hard to miss.
They are. I know. They are totes adorbs." Okay, so he realizes, "Lady Jane, you've got a man." She tells him a little bit about the man. He's slightly younger than her. She hadn't seen him in 20 years. And she admits, yes, it's Bree's daddy. And he's big and red-haired and Scottish. And then she says, quote, "Bree is where the favor comes in," unquote. So her asking him about, to keep it honest and tell her like it is about her attractiveness was not the favor. And we're actually not going to know all the favor for like a book or so, right?
Right.
Okay. So they chat for 2 hours. So something went down. After that, she leaves the hospital for the last time, leaving behind a letter of resignation, all documents to handle her property until Brianna is of age, and another one to be executed to turn over everything to her at that time. Quote, as I drove out of the parking lot, I experienced a feeling of mingled panic, regret, and elation. I was on my way. Unquote. Deborah C. writes, Claire is super excited that she can talk freely about Jamie. At this point, we don't know how much she revealed to Joe other than that she needed Joe to watch after Bree. Was he aware of her final arrangements, all the stuff one does in anticipation of leaving forever, as in even up to death? If so, then she must have told him about time travel. Did he believe her? I would actually love to have had that scene in the book. That's exciting. Me too. Eileen P. writes, we find Claire needing reassurance about her sex appeal. She is concerned about whether Jamie will find her appealing after 20 years apart. This anxiety is understandable. After all, what would she do if she goes back in time and Jamie doesn't want her? It's interesting that she never questions whether or not she will want him after 20 years apart. For her, there is no other answer than, of course she will. It doesn't matter to her if he's changed, or maybe she's assuming he hasn't. I love the relationship between Claire and Joe. They are like siblings and buddies combined. Such trust and a wonderful rapport. He brings humor to her life. She misses that with Jamie and certainly doesn't get that from Frank. It's great that Joe is so happy that she got a man. It's about time, he says. It's a great friend that figures out your husband is not your daughter's father, but keeps it to himself until you're ready to talk about it. So supportive. So many good insights, Eileen. Goodness. Joe B. writes, Claire gets a chance to show her diagnostic abilities on a skull, a nod to Shakespeare's Hamlet, perhaps? The skull and the body are of a Caucasian woman, but found in a cave with African artifacts. Claire can sense the emotion of the woman who didn't want to die but met a violent end. This scene is different in content and in tone. It gives us a glimpse into Claire the professional and Claire the friend. In this scene, she is in control and sure of herself, in contrast to the uncertainties she is facing with Bree and Jamie. With no spoilers, but never dismiss anything as important. She continues, like in other chapters and the book as a whole, identity forms a theme of this chapter. Joe Abernathy's son is searching or creating his own new identity in contrast with Joe himself, who has seemingly been able to integrate the unknown family history into his own self. Bree is engaging with her personal history, and Claire is seeking confirmation that her self-assessment is correct. Joe is so happy for a new/old relationship for Claire. It's been clear to Joe that Frank can't be Bree's father, and I wonder how much he knows about the day-to-day relationship between Claire and Frank. I get a sense that it's a lot. It is with Joe's validation and support that she can start to talk more freely about Jamie. Lisa T. writes, Joe's line, just call me Ishmael, is rather ironic as Ishmael is the name that Lenny has taken for himself, but it is also the opening line of Moby Dick. In a way, it is the beginning of Joe's story and history as well. I think it's honest and human of Claire to wonder if she's still attractive. Claire is never really insecure, but she closed herself off for so long, she doesn't quite trust her own gaze.
She thinks it's also like Lenny's battle with trying to, you know, break the bonds of their connection with slavery. So like that could be like the great white whale.
It could be. And Lisa finishes, can't wait to meet Joe on screen. He's such a character and a true friend. Martina P. writes, throughout the last chapters, there were a lot of unfavorable mentions of certain body images. I forgave Claire for it because she simply must feel insecure at this point. 20 years is a long time, and she must be utterly nervous about her impending journey back to the 18th century and to Jamie. It manifests in the scene where she is seeking validation of her appearance from Joe Abernathy. Her sexual insecurities are probably attributable to Frank's behavior. She needs that validation because sex was such a big part of Jamie and Claire's relationship and communication. The thought that Jamie could no longer find her sexually attractive must have been on her mind and had to be ruled out. Claire's diagnosis of the skeleton is now creepy. I love the dialogue between Claire and Joe and how he correctly guessed that Frank couldn't be Bree's dad. I don't know if it's clear from the text how much she actually tells Joe. Did she tell him about the time traveling, or did she simply say that she was going to live in Scotland and he should look after Bree in her absence? Anything else for chapter 20?
I do not. But I think this chapter did a lot more for building the relationship between Claire and Joe than the last one did.
Oh, heck yeah.
So I think that the other one kind of showed you where it began, and this one kind of fleshed it out and kind of gave you a hint of what they've done since then. So
I want to know, I want Diana to write. I mean, we find out more indirectly later, which I won't say what it is, but I want Diana to write a letter. She's written so many letters, like maybe not a novella, but maybe a novella, just like a scene. I want her to write those 2 hours.
What 2 hours?
The 2 hours that she just told us she spent talking to Joe.
Ah, okay. I was like, just 2 hours? I want the whole 20 years. What's wrong with you?
No, I want her and Joe's 2 hours.
There's more than 2 hours I want of her and Joe. That was chapter 20. Next, we'll move on to chapter 21, entitled QED.
Lisa T. starts us off with QED is a Latin abbreviation for quod erat demonstrandum. It is used in math to show that the proof is complete. In this case, it is the proof. Inverness, October 5th, 1968. Claire is back in Scotland. Roger found the deed of Sassine. She notes in Roger and Bree's interaction that they have become more comfortable and intimate with each other. Brianna found the text of an article published in a journal called Foresters, put out by a printer named Alexander Malcolm in Edinburgh in 1765. That was almost 20 years after she had left Jamie. The handwriting looked as if it were, quote, written by someone of difficult penmanship, here cramped and there sprawling, perhaps the writing of a left-handed man who wrote most painfully with his right hand, unquote. They compare that with the published article and then compare the handwriting with the deed of Sassine. It's Jamie.
Now, they did this at the end of the last season too.
They did a quick and dirty. They didn't know. They didn't do any, like, they did the deed of Sassine, right? They didn't do an article.
No, but they did the deed of Sassine, however they pronounced it on the show.
Yes.
They did include that at the end of the last season, but they used that as, that was the proof. That was the proof that they found, that she found.
For Claire, yeah.
That she found to prove it to Bree.
That she went back.
And to Roger. Yeah, that it happened when she, you know, when got about to telling Bree the story.
Yeah, so that was what they did. And it kind of, it was the same part of it. Because here it's two parts. Here it's the Dita Say scene brought Claire into it here in the book in Voyager, but it was like a secondary confirmation of this handwriting. So they knew his handwriting from the deed and they were able to link it to this guy 20 years later. So that was, proof, unequivocal proof. What I believe they're going to have to do obviously like episode 1, 2, whatever, early on in season 3 is they're going to have to now hunt him down, right? Because what they did was they found, They got to the point where they said, we believe he's still alive. Or number one, they believed her because they saw Galus go through and they found the deed, right? But they didn't do his trail, right? They didn't find the print shop yet.
Correct.
Okay. So there's still some sleuthing to do. So hopefully we get it'll be probably quick and dirty, but hopefully we'll get some sleuthing. So they also look at Claire's signature on the deed. Proof positive that she was there. Proof she had signed it. Jamie had signed himself QED, as Lisa pointed out. Quote, I had an absurd urge to tear the manuscript pages out of their plastic shrouds and clutch them in my hands to feel the ink and paper he had touched, the certain evidence that he had survived, unquote.
I mean, there would be stranger reactions to that. That I would, like, if she's like, I wanted to eat it to become one with this. Or one of those strange addiction shows. Remember those strange addiction shows?
I don't think I ever saw
my strange addiction. The people who like eat like cotton balls.
I saw
like
talking
dryer
about it.
Lint.
I don't want to talk about it. That's gross.
Doll hair.
Was it that one where the woman licked her cat?
I don't know.
I think that was, I didn't see the episode, but I saw like the advertisement for it. I think she licked her cat.
Do you lick your cat, Ginger?
Summer, that is the most disgusting thing
ever. It comes
ever.
Real close. You do come real close.
I don't ever know. No, Summer.
Are you sure?
He had inserted a phrase from Burns, which he had learned from Claire, since Burns was 6 years old in 1765. And of course, this phrase was inserted into the article that they found. So Roger says, "And if time goes on in parallel, as we think it does," Bree says, "then you can go back, Mama. You can find him." And they're off. Claire searches for a good enough dress to go back in. She selects one, quote, "floor length, three-quarter sleeves edged with lace, a deep tawny gold with shimmers of brown and amber and sherry in the heavy silk." Unquote.
I love how she's instantly like a costume designer. She's like, I can tack this on. Is there something I could get without a zipper? Do you have this? This isn't appropriate for the time period. Like, this is one of those beggars can't be choosers moments. Like, unless if Frank hadn't taken the time to burn her other dress, she would have had something to wear back. However, he did. So
In the show.
In the show. It was me making a show reference. Just saying, in the show world, if he hadn't burned her good dress, she could have gone back in that. And then she really would have been a ghost, right? If she'd shown up wearing the exact same dress she'd left in.
I don't know.
That would have blown his mind.
Oh, I'm blowing something.
Oh, she'll take care of that. Print shop.
Whoa. Hey-o. Whoa. Hello. So the only negative about the dress was zippers. Anne S. writes, "As the bits of evidence stack up to deliver Jamie to Claire, the reality of Claire leaving Bree alone becomes real. I have thought, if I could leave my kids like this forever. I have no idea." That's a hard one, Anne. Regarding dress shopping, Anne writes, "I remember the popularity of Jessica McClintock dresses in the 70s. Everyone wore one to prom, and I even recently ran across one I sewed back then. A mess of gingham patterns, laces, and rules. God awful, but it could have worked in the 18th century."
I'm so Googling that right now.
What? Jessica McClintock? Deborah C. writes, "Does this relate to the draft of an article Roger and Bree found with annotations seeming to be in Jamie's handwriting, similar to his writing of the deed of Sacing, and finished article published by Alexander Malcolm Printer? Do the notes prove Jamie is a Malcolm? QED is also the way the author of this article signed it, as if to say his article proves his point." Regarding dressing, Deborah C. writes, "Luckily, 18th century style dresses were in vogue in 1968, so Claire finds a dress that could pass for 18th century fashion. The designer in the late 60s who created long vintage style dresses using calico and lace was Jessica McClintock, and she worked for the Gunny Sacks Company in San Francisco. They were called granny dresses. This must be what Diana was drawing on when she created the fictional Jessica Gutenberg dresses on the rack in Inverness."
Claire, can you imagine anyone like going, "I would really love a granny dress. Could you find me a granny dress, please?"
Goodness. No, but I will say it's so funny you say that because it's closed now. But I remember in the 90s when I was in high school, we were in Oklahoma, the musical, not the state, and going, I was in the chorus. I had one little line, which I could sing, but I won't. And
thank you.
We went down with our dad drove a group of us girls, obviously from the musical, from our Northern California town to San Francisco. We went to the Gunny Sack outlet. It was still around.
That was not why you went there.
So we went to get costumes.
No, you didn't. We went there every year for choir dresses.
Oh, so where did we go to get costumes? I got my costumes at Deseret.
Goodwill.
Deseret. Sorry. I'm a little backwards. You're right. We did go there. I'm just combining or mixing up the trips. But yeah, it was to get... So we went there more than once. I don't think we went all 4 years, but we went there more than once to get our choir. You're right, our choir gowns. But yeah, so Summer and I have been there multiple times. I don't think it exists anymore, but it did in the 90s. Eileen P. writes, "You can tell Claire is in a rush to go back to Jamie because rather than having an 18th century dress made for her, she's buying off the rack." Well, she doesn't have a lot of time. If it's still the 5th, she has time, maybe not a lot of time. But if it were like the 30th, she ain't got no time for that because she's leaving soon. Joe B. writes, Bree has changed over the last 6 months. She's gone from angry denial to bemused acceptance to now an active and vocal encourager. Bree's encouragement allows Claire to take each new step toward actually going back. In the dress shop, Claire again finds validation in the enthusiasm of a salesperson, but takes it for what it is. Jessica Gutenberg improbably asks us to relive the romance of the 18th century. Of all people, Claire isn't persuaded by such an unrealistic statement. She may be returning in the hope of and belief of love, but she knows many of the realities and dangers of that time. Is this highly romanticized but impractical invitation to look at the past through rose-colored glasses, taking only the surface view of the time, usually from the perspective of the rich? One of the things Diana does so well is address some of the nitty-gritty of the reality of life for her characters as they live in their times. I've never read anyone else who addresses how to manage menstruation in 18th century. The dresses and advertising, like Tessa and the Impetuous Pirate, contrast the divide between fantasy and reality, and Claire recognizes both for what they are. Martina P. writes, on her return from Boston, Claire notices that Bree and Roger have become much closer and more comfortable with each other. I don't think she had different expectations, and maybe leaving Brianna there together with Roger in the same house was not unintentional. It is clear that Claire likes Roger a lot, and it probably gives her comfort knowing that he could be of great support to Brianna when she is gone.
I mean, he's clearly already gotten her seal of approval.
She's already pregnant.
What?
You're just kidding.
I'm like, what are you talking about?
Just no. Seeing if you're listening.
Clearly I'm listening. I'm responding to something you just said. I don't know why you would jump there anyway.
I didn't jump anywhere. I'm just trying to see if you're listening to me because you already said that you shut me out.
She's clearly already given her seal of approval with Roger. Mm-hmm. She knows him. She likes him. And she wants someone to be behind on this end for Bree when she goes. Why wouldn't she want her to be settled and with some, you know, and with the prospect of her soulmate that she's heading off to go be with hers. Why wouldn't she encourage that?
Martina continues, Claire must be getting a little stressed out about her preparations for the journey. How else could we excuse her behavior in the Sarah Gutenberg dress store? Does she even realize how judgmental and rude she is to that poor sales clerk? Mm-hmm. Anything else about chapter 21?
No, I mean, this all could have been one chapter. That's all I have to say.
I know. Well, only because they're on different continents, so maybe not.
Well, 21 and 22 could have been the same
21
chapter.
21 and 22, maybe, yeah.
They were
but not
all
20.
Prep.
Yes.
And 23, going right into 23, considering she uses, what do they call them, the whale penises so often?
Excuse me?
In the chapters, the whale penises. The donkey donks, whatever you want to call them.
I'm just kidding. I don't know what it is.
Whale dongs. She uses those all the time. This would have been a perfect point to use whale dong and had it be one chapter.
To use whale dong. Summer, that's classless.
Is it?
Yes.
Have you met me?
That's true.
All right. So moving on to chapter 22 entitled.
That's going to be an outtake. There's never a better time for a whale dong.
Ever.
Okay, go ahead.
Chapter 22 entitled All Hallows Eve.
Claire is ready. For money, she has two golden guineas, 6 sovereigns, 23 shillings and 18 ninepence, 10 halfpence and 12 farthings, and a little plastic baggie of doits. I'm guessing they're pronounced. The smallest denomination of Scottish currency of the time. Roger and Bree
I believe those are pronounced doits. I'm just kidding.
I was like, you better be. Roger and Bree had gone about London for 4 days. Are you stuck on those?
No. I just thought it was funny. And then you were like, wait, what? No. No. Oh, no. You're funny.
All right. You're trying to get a reaction out of me.
Mm-hmm. Good Lord. Stop it. Don't you know it doesn't always work?
But it's spelled do-its. Oh, Summer. Roger and Bree had gone about London for 4 days to get all of this together. They reflect on the face value worth of the coins then and now, and how ironically, both then and now, the coins were worth a lot more than their face value. After dinner, Roger asked her, After dinner, Roger asked Claire to do him a favor, to close her eyes, go outside, and then tell him the first thing that she saw when she opened them. Apparently, this was a popular divination custom on Halloween. And it had, when she went out and came back in, or they went out to see her, what she had seen, it actually had been a policeman, and she'd run into him.
Okay, Roger can we says, stop right here?
Sure.
I'm going to need you to walk outside right now. Close your eyes.
I am not going outside.
And tell me the first thing you see. Tell me the first thing you see.
It's going to be a bush.
Just do it. Come on.
Summer, it is dark and I have neighbors and the answer is no. I'll go into my bedroom.
Let the record show that Ginger did not want to participate in this episode very much.
It's not Halloween. Halloween, I'll do it, but not tonight.
Okay. Fine.
Roger says that to see a man coming toward you on Samhain means that you'll find what you seek. Now, as they celebrate the evening, Brianna has insisted on carving a pumpkin, and it was lit, and it was on the sideboard, kind of overseeing their festivities. Before it's time to go to bed, Claire and Brianna hug fiercely, and she ends with, "See you in the morning, baby," and Claire goes up to bed. Brianna is sad, of course, and Roger tries to comfort her. Quote, "She might be able to come back. We don't know." Unquote. But Bree knows better, and she knows they belong together, Jamie and Claire. But Bree says that she also needs her. Now, what follows is another one of the most touching scenes Diana has written.
"She's all that's left, Roger. The only one who really knows me. She and Daddy... Frank," she corrected herself. "They were the ones who knew me from the beginning, the ones who saw me learn to walk and were proud of me when I did something good in school, and who..." She broke off, and the tears overflowed, leaving gleaming tracks in the firelight. "This sounds really dumb," she said with sudden violence. "Really, really dumb. But it's..." She groped, helpless, then sprang to her feet, unable to stay still. "It's like there are all these things I don't even know," she said, pacing with quick, angry steps. "Do you think I remember what I looked like learning to walk, or what the first word I said was? No, but Mama does. And that's so stupid, because what difference does it make? It doesn't make any difference at all, but it's important. It matters because she thought it was. And, oh, Roger, if she's gone, there won't be a soul left in the world who cares what I'm like or thinks I'm special, not because of anything, but just because I'm me. She's the only person in the world who really, really cares I was born. And if she's gone..." She stood still on the hearthrug, hands clenched at her sides and mouth twisted with the effort to control herself, tears wet on her cheeks. And her shoulders slumped, and the tension went out of her tall figure.
Roger tells her that all of the boxes that the Reverend had kept of his stuff, of Roger's stuff, though he'd never even gone through them, it mattered that they were there. They were his history. And then he says, "You're wrong, you know. It isn't only your mother who cares." And later, after Bree has gone to bed, the jack-o'-lantern flame is dying out. Claire comes back down, and they chat about Halloween and Roger's childhood. And then Roger says, "I'll take care of her, you know. You know that, don't you?" "I know," she says softly.
Which, that whole statement would have been hella creepy if Bree wasn't into him.
Well, yeah.
Like, if it wasn't Roger and it was just some rando, I'm like, "I'll take care of her, you know."
That's gross.
Exactly.
She tells him she doesn't think she can say goodbye to Bree, so that she wrote her a letter, and she asks Roger to give it to him. What?
What?
And she asks... And she asks Roger to give it to her.
That's worse. To give it... You can't say give it to Bree either. That's worse.
Give the letter to her. Okay. She asks him to give...
What letter is it? The D?
Summer. She asks him to give her the letter.
Indeed.
She's arranged for a car to pick her up the next morning before dawn and to therefore be able to leave before Bree wakes up. Quote, "Thank you, Roger. Thank you for everything." She leaned over and kissed him lightly on the lips. Then she rose and went out, a white ghost in the darkness of the hall, borne on the Halloween wind.
Otherwise known as Samhain?
Lisa T. writes, "And we get a wee glimpse into Roger's heart. He seems to be burning rather badly for Bree."
Seems?
Yeah.
He's been pretty blatant about it.
Since DIA. Anne S. writes, Is it just me or is Claire's goodbye with Roger way more touching than anything with Bree? Theirs is an interesting/disturbing connection. Bree goes to bed and Claire finds Roger. In a way, she's already left the present time. I agree with that last statement. She's already kind of said goodbye. I mean, yes, she'll see her the next day, but she's already protected herself against that emotional goodbye, that hug they had and those words that they had. That was her goodbye, I think. She was prepping herself.
With Bree?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. She's just saying right here she has no intention of saying goodbye.
Seeing her. Absolutely.
Yeah. She's like, I did what I did because that's like, all I could handle. And I think that's all that Bree could handle.
And just wait till we have the letter written, till the letter is exposed. That'll be another Davina moment because holy crap, that letter. I mean, whoo. Okay. Deborah C. writes, Bree goes to bed. Roger stays up. He can never sleep on All Hallows. Claire comes down and joins him. He tells her that when he was young, he peed on his windowsill to keep ghosts from entering his bedroom. Now, this recalls Jamie and Claire's return to Lallybroch in DIA, Jenny to Jamie. Quote, "And if you've been in the high field, remember to piss on the doorposts on your way back in. That's how you keep a ghost from coming in the house," unquote.
Would she explain why children wet their beds so often?
Because they're trying to keep ghosts out?
Keep ghosts out of their beds.
Out of their beds, summer. Or keep them out of their pants. I mean,
all of those.
"That's how you keep a ghost from coming in the house," she explained to me in a lowered tone. Remember, McNabb's cottage was near the high field. Mm. Eileen P. writes, "Through the past few chapters, Claire and Brianna have had to deal not only with the excitement of finding Jamie, but the very real possibility of being permanently separated. There is interplay between Claire and Brianna as each clue leads to Jamie. Claire gets excited, then realizes she'll have to leave Brianna. Then Brianna reassures her. It is such a bittersweet situation, yet it is relieved by the growing closeness between Brianna and Roger. It makes it easier for Claire to leave the nest if Brianna not only leaves the nest too, but has the possibility of a life with Roger. Roger, Jamie, and Claire share a belief in superstitions. Well, why not? After all, Claire's a time traveler, and magic happens. So if the first thing you see on Halloween after you walk out your door with your eyes closed can predict your future, it's worth a try. Fortunately, it worked out in Claire's favor. Yay, no ducks. Break out the whiskey." And of course, ducks refers to what Roger was saying, that one example of bad luck is if you see a duck with his head under his wing or something like that.
Like hiding his head?
Yeah. Joe B. writes, "I like the mix of practical with the mystical in this chapter. Preparations of money and eating a last meal together meet with folklore. The Celtic omens are good for Claire, seeing a man walking toward her, thus she will find what she seeks. Claire and Roger acknowledge the power of Halloween even now." We see that Claire is too overwhelmed to really say what she feels, but she and Bree have been physically close all night, her actions displaying her feelings. Once Claire had gone up, we see an example of how Bree is turning to Roger for reassurance, and however much she knows why her mother should go, even wants her to go, it's a time for Bree to express her feelings of loss, of losing the one person who has been constant in her life, who knows all the things about you that you can't. Roger, whose historical expertise has been put to use, now can share his experience with grief. What's important is that somewhere someone remembers. Also his chance to share some of his heart. And he does so well treading the fine line between honesty and sincerity while not taking too much advantage of her vulnerability. There's a special relationship developing between Roger and Claire, and she can be differently honest with him than she can be with her daughter. She can express her fears about the journey, Bree, and even what she'll find at the end to him, but not to Bree.
Well, she doesn't care. I mean, Roger's feelings aren't important to her to the degree that Bree's are.
Of course.
So she can be more blunt and not worry about hurting his feelings because they aren't as intimately connected as she is with Bree.
A natural desire to protect a child, perhaps, she says. She leaves a letter for Bree with Roger, who tactfully gives Claire a chance to back out. Claire is so torn, but with the decision made, will leave early alone. Claire can't say goodbye to Bree if she sees her, so she won't, but she kisses Roger goodbye and thanks him for everything. A loaded phrase. What he's done for her, for Bree, what he will do once she's gone as well for himself.
So do you think that she gave Roger the kiss in a way, in kind of like the, not a foreshadowing, but almost in the way that in the next chapter, Brianna gives her the kiss?
I think it's a nice parallel. I think you could say that. Martina P. writes, interesting descriptions of Scottish Samhain customs and rituals. Just one question. Why exactly are ducks a bad omen? To hear a duck quacking is actually a most fortunate omen, indicating the coming of prosperity. A flying duck is a good sign, particularly for those who are troubled and sad. Ducks are always a welcome sight. Maybe it's only a bad omen on one day out of the year. Well, Martina, this is Ginger. I haven't studied those or that, but it also could be different among cultures. So Celtic versus Germanic versus
I have an idea.
Native. Yeah.
Ducks are migratory.
Mm-hmm.
A duck there in that area in October.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not a very lucky lucky duck.
Lucky duck.
Because he should have migrated because it's about to get real, real cold.
So maybe a duck at that point in time.
Exactly. Might not be the smartest of ducks. So maybe a duck at that time of year
is on its way down.
Exactly.
This chapter is loaded with emotions. Excitement, sadness, love. It's all there. So excited for Claire and her journey back to Jamie, however, it does break my heart a little when Bree breaks down, and it is clear how emotionally difficult it will be for her to let her mom go. She felt that there was no one left who cared. It is quite wonderful and touching to be reassured by the text that Roger does care and manages to give her comfort. Roger has quite the weakness for the Randall women, to include Claire. Is it just me, or do I detect flirtations between Roger and Claire throughout the last chapters? When we are in Roger's POV, it does feel to me that Roger is fascinated with Claire. Then again, who wouldn't be? Now, girl, I've said this since day one to Kingdom Come. Of course there's something there. I'm not saying there's going to be anything developing, but there is an attraction, specifically on Roger's part. But they do have a very interesting relationship, but I think the attraction is on Roger's side as far as being pulled in by this creature. Anything else about chapter 22?
I would like to state that what I've loved about this book series so much is that the first time I read it, I was childless and in my late teens, early 20s. And every successive reread, I get a little something new and something different. And honestly, I think this is my second reread because I started rereading it before we started the read-along the first time for when we started the podcast. I had just started a read-along. But every time I read it, I get something a little bit different out of it. But this has been my first involved reread since I've become a mother. I just think that I have
a different outlook.
I have a very different outlook, different feelings, just a different view of the things. And by the things, I mean like all the things, like all the mm-hmm. different points of view. Like when Bree has her whole conversation, when she says, you know, she's the only one who knows me, who mm-hmm. cares about me in those ways. That whole section had a different feeling to me as just a daughter.
Mm-hmm. But once I became a mother, it added a whole different spectrum to that whole monologue, to where not only do I see it from my point of view, but I can potentially see it from my daughter's point of view. And, you know, being that close with my daughter and being a single parent, seeing that how she might have those same feelings if, God, I mean, this would never be a situation that came up between me and my daughter. I will never be going through the stones.
Because of time travel?
Because time travel. I will never be leaving my daughter in, you know, the 21st century and headed back to, you know, the 18th century. That's never going to happen. This specific situation will never happen between me and my daughter. Some sort of parallel could occur to where she may have this feeling. And God, it was so highlighted this week and in the last 2 days. And that's why this whole chapter was harder to read, because as everyone knows now, Carrie Fisher passed away. And the next day her mother passed away. And all I could think about was her poor daughter who lost her mom her grandma.
Yeah.
Within 2 days. And I just imagining this could have been her monologue. This could have been something that is going through her head. You know, these are the only people who know me like this. There will never be anyone else who knows me the way these women knew me. And I just, I don't know. It made it a lot harder to read.
So now you're getting mushy.
I know, but that's what I love about these books is that
it's different. Time, every time you read it, can be different throughout your life.
It is, but what's so great about it is that the story hasn't changed. What's changed is me. And even as I change, if the books never change, I find new things in them, which I find exciting and has been one of the joys for me over the years with this book series.
Well, yeah, you have to announce the next one.
Okay, then I guess as if I'm done, we're moving on to chapter 23. Now to chapter 23, which is the last chapter in part 5 before we move on to part 6. And this one's real short, y'all. It's 2 pages. Get tight. Sit tight, everyone. 2 pages. Craig Nadine.
The next morning, Claire has made it to the hill. She tells the driver not to wait. She approaches the stones, and it hits her, the reality of what she's about to do. Because this time, it's a choice, and she knows what it's like, and it's for good reasons, not scary, sad reasons like it was the second time, but that puts the responsibility thus on her. So it's a different kind of scary, if you will. But the time she gets out to the stone circle, it's dawn, and Bree and Roger are already waiting for her. Bree is there in a lime green, may I say, god-awful Jessica Gutenberg dress to see her off. Now, Brianna knows she can go through herself, and she knows Roger can. And she tells Claire, if you don't go, I will.
Don't you see, Mama? He has to know. Has to know he did it. He did what he meant to for us. Her lips quivered and she pressed them together for a minute. We owe it to him, Mama, she said softly. Somebody has to find him and tell him. Her hand touched my face briefly. Tell him I was born. Oh, Bree, I said, my voice so choked I could barely speak. Oh, Bree. She was holding my hands tight between her own, squeezing hard. He gave you to me, she said, so low I could hardly hear her. Now I have to give you back to him, Mama. The eyes that were so like Jamie's looked down at me, blurred by tears. If you find him, she whispered, when you find my father, give him this. She bent and kissed me, fiercely, gently, then straightened and turned me toward the stone. Go, Mama, she said, breathless. I love you. Go. From the corner of my eye, I saw Roger move toward her. I took one step, and then another. I heard a sound, a faint roaring. I took the last step, and the world disappeared.
Anne S. writes, bye, Brianna. Hello, Jamie. Now on to the good stuff. And why does Bree... just not go back with Claire right then. Well, she's got a budding She has to. Does she graduate yet?
No, she's got to go finish college.
Yeah, she's got to finish school. She's got to do Roger stuff. And, you know, she's got to Roger.
No, Deborah C. She doesn't do that now.
Shush. It's the plans, Dan. Deborah C. writes, I was surprised that Brie and Roger weren't as affected by or drawn to the stones as they were when Gales disappeared. That's a good point, too. I think, you can't say the fire because the fire was over and above. You don't need the fire. But
there was no dead bodies right there.
Yeah, but like I know the dead body and the fire, those are not things that you need. Although certainly, I guess a sacrifice wouldn't, you don't need it, but I guess it could make it stronger. I guess it was just like the drama of the event. I don't know. Eileen P. writes, Claire's heart being torn to pieces by leaving Brie. Claire's heart being torn to pieces by not going to Jamie. Claire being torn to pieces by going through the screaming chaos of the stones. The decision is tearing Claire apart. It is Brianna who provides the final and decisive reason for Claire to return to Jamie. Quote, to tell him Brianna was born. Joe B. writes, once again, a choice is to be made at Cray na Dun. Claire sends the car away, taking away temptation. But like after the witch trial, despite the pull of Frank and now the pull of Brie, she can't help herself moving toward Jamie. Unexpectedly, Brie and Roger, who look a bit guilty, are waiting for Claire, and Brie has been making her own preparations in a Jessica Gutenberg of her own. Claire's very English gift for understatement belies her shock at both seeing her and at the clear plan Brie has. I wonder if Brie really would go, or is this a strategy to make sure Claire goes? Brie's argument that they owe Jamie, that it's time for Brie to give her mother back to the man she loves, and with Fraser's stubbornness that someone has to go, and if it's not you, it's me, gives Claire a final permission to go, and so she does.
Can we talk about how different this story would have been if Claire hadn't gone and Brie had gone?
There would be no print shop.
That's true. I don't know how that would happen. Yeah.
Well, actually, there would have been a print shop. It just would have been significantly different.
I don't know. No, I don't see. Claire has the experience. Brianna is all thumbs. She doesn't know about time travel. She wouldn't know where. Ass from her elbow, as they say. I don't know. I just think she would need help. She would do fine if she had her mom there to help her and to teach her the ropes, if you will. But Claire, no. Lisa T. writes, Claire is shocked to find Roger and Brie at the Stone Circle. Brie is determined to travel if Claire won't. We see that Brie has grown into an independent young woman in this scene. She is no longer a child needing her parent. She has the courage to find her father and send her mother through the stones. In finding and accepting Jamie as her father, Brie has grown from a spoiled child into a compassionate young woman. This is a major turning point in Claire's story, but it is a huge one for Brie as well. Brie gives her mother back to Jamie, which is quite remarkable. Yes, she is so like her father. Martina P. writes, I couldn't love Brie more in this chapter. I love how she takes action with the stubbornness and willfulness so like her father's daughter and ultimately gives Claire the permission to go. What a beautiful and heartbreaking moment when Brie tells Claire that they both owed it to Jamie to let him know that she was born and that he gave Claire to her and now she had to give her back to him. OMG, I can't breathe. At first, I thought Roger might have alarmed Brie that Claire was going off on her own because goodbye would have been too difficult. But then Brie was totally prepared. That's true. She had already purchased the lime green Jessica Gutenberg dress. She had it planned all along and would have gone through the stones to find her father if Claire had not. This chapter is filled with emotions from the first to the last.
And that was the end of part 5, you guys. It's happening. Part 6. We are about to do my favorite thing in the whole book series.
Really?
Which is...
in all 8 books?
Yes.
Good law. Okay.
It's to put my people back together.
Put your people...
because once you put them back together, then it's just 8 more books of trying to rip them back apart and rape people.
It's not 8 more books. It's 5 more books. Plus 2 more, maybe. So maybe 7 if we get 10.
I'm just saying. Yes, once we get them back together, it's about them
fighting to stay together, which is not nearly as beautiful to me as coming back together after 20 years.
So yes, we're excited to get to the print shop eventually.
All right.
Very soon.
So join us next time when we start part six. Part six is entitled Edinburgh and chapter 24 entitled A Malcolm Printer.
Thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @outlanderpod. That my young life.